Welcome to another KPI podcast. I'm Paul Sutar, your host. We're here today with Dave Traubert, president of the Kansas Policy Institute. Welcome, Dave.
Hi, Paul.
We have a really interesting topic today, something that the legislature's wrestling with and likely will be for a while. We're going to talk about school funding formula. Evidently, there aren't many people who understand that, how that works. Give us our listeners just a quick overview of what the problem is and what's the status right now.
Well, Paul, you know, the school funding formula is probably one of the most discussed and least understood subjects in Kansas. I would venture to say there are fewer than five people in the entire state who truly understand how that formula works. And that's one of the problems. You know, how can you understand how to fund schools if you're using a formula that you don't understand what that's going to really mean, if changes in it, how that's going to impact not only taxpayers, but individual school districts? We're counting our involvement in school finance lawsuits in the decades now. This formula clearly doesn't work. It's just, we think it's irreparably broken, and there's a lot of people who agree with that. What we think needs to happen, and I think this is where the legislature is going, is to sunset the current formula, just take it out of statute. And it's going to take time to build a new formula. It could take 2 years. There's a tremendous amount of research that has to go into this to do it right. And so the proposal I think we're going to see is to give districts a block grant of funding, basically give them the funding they were supposed to receive this year, which would be a record amount, and let them operate off that for the next 2 years while the legislature is doing its due diligence and putting a new formula together.
Okay. Yeah, that's a real challenging topic. Schools have been beating that drum for a long time. And as you say, a lot of people just don't even understand it, especially people inside the school system.
Right. You know, the schools tend to say, well, the formula works if you fund it. But I would say that depends on what you mean by work. How do you define it? What is it working for? Now, there's no question that it might work for the institutions and the adults in the system because it gives them more money, but it's not working for students.
Well, and the Kansas Supreme Court decision last year, that was in March, if I remember correctly, they made a pretty monumental shift in how that's looked at, didn't they?
They did. The Supreme Court's previous court rulings had been based on the Augenblick and Myers cost study. This time, the Supreme Court said it's not a cost study. The first test is, are students meeting the required outcomes? Are they meeting or exceeding what is now defined as the Rose standards? And if so, then they must be getting an adequate funding. If not, then you need to look at, in terms of how do you measure the funding? How do you determine what they actually need to do that? And they also said that in doing that analysis, all of the funding sources count, not just the base state aid. And that's one of the problems with the formula. That's a piece of the current school funding formula. That's not the only thing that counts. All funding counts, all funding sources, local, federal, state, even the CAPERS pension costs. They also said, and this is critical, that the cost studies that the lower court used in its ruling in Gannon are more akin to estimates than the certainties the lower court believes exist from that cost study. And part of that reason is the cost of that Augenblick and Myers cost study has been proven now to have been inflated to artificially produce higher numbers because they didn't take efficient use of taxpayer money into account as they said they would.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of important to look at what you're actually producing. And one of the points that you made, that KPI's made in some recent publication on this, is that if you look at how districts are actually performing, if you believe the schools, the school lobbyists' perspective, they would say, well, the schools that are getting the better funding are going to produce better students. But that's not necessarily the case. Tell me about DeSoto and the Gardner-Edgerton districts.
Yeah, that's a classic example. We looked at the six count districts in Johnson County and found that the two districts that have the highest outcomes on state assessments also happen to have the lowest current operating cost per pupil. It doesn't matter how much you have to spend. It matters how you spend the money. And what you find when you start looking at where a lot of the money goes, one of the things we looked at, for example, was the money spent on administration. DeSoto has the best operating cost on administration. If the Blue Valley District operated at the same per pupil cost as DeSoto, they'd spend $8.4 million less just on administration. It's where the money, where they put their emphasis. And it's, you know, in total, if all the Johnson County districts operated at the same per pupil cost as DeSoto, just in that county, the taxpayers would have to spend $127 million less.
That's not just chump change there.
No, it's not. And you know, it's part of the problem when you're looking at student achievement is you have to deconstruct it. You can't just look at an average because every district has a different type of different student body makeup. So we did this analysis based on looking at the kids who are low income and the kids who are not low income because there are some unfortunate and unnecessary achievement gaps there. But that will, if you have more of one than the other, that will skew the average. And so when you pull that apart, you find the absolute evidence that more money does not translate to more achievement, or less money does not translate to less achievement. There comes a point where you cut it too far, and it would have an impact.
Right. You make a good point with the differences in various groups within the school system. In spite of the huge increase in school funding over the last couple of decades especially, 36% of white students in Kansas in the 2014 graduating class scored well enough on the ACT exam to be considered college ready in English, reading, math, and science. Now, that's a pretty low number right there, 36%. But when you compare that to what Hispanic and African American students achieved, that's something to crow about because the African American and Hispanic students, 14%, only 14%, according to the ACT, are prepared for college in English, reading, math, and science. And among African American students, it's only 7%. That sounds broke to me.
It does. And when we look at that, we say this school funding formula isn't working for students. Maybe it works for the institutions. It gives them a lot more money, but it certainly isn't working for students. You look at the same thing applies to the National Assessment of Educational Progress. You have only 36% of fourth graders reading proficiently in Kansas. But when you look at the scores of the low-income kids and compared to others, low-income kids are about 3 years worth of learning behind their peers in the fourth grade. This is not a funding system that is working for students, and that's what this is supposed to be about, not the institutions. You know, beyond having fewer than five people who really understand this, we know that the formula is giving districts more than they need. We've done some research on carryover cash balances that shows that districts have taken over $400 million of money given to them to educate students and increase their cash reserves with it, probably because the formula is giving them more than they need to provide the services. We find district after district acknowledging now that they choose in many cases to operate inefficiently. I served on the K-12 Commission on School Efficiency and Student Achievement this past year and found that we had districts coming in to talk about how can we make more money available to the classroom by making better use of taxpayer resources. And a number of them acknowledged that, well, we could make some changes. We could buy things differently. We could buy more in bulk and use better opportunities, but they didn't want to. And they had a lot of reasons, but no matter how you justify it, it's for local control, it's the way we think we want to do it. It really comes down to one fact, and that's that you're taking money away from classrooms by spending it unnecessarily on something else. And that is what has a direct impact on students and why it's not working for students. So, you know, we think that we need a new formula that is understandable to everyone. It should be easy to follow. It should require that school districts make efficient use of the taxpayer money so that they're getting what they need, but not more than they need, and unnecessarily taxing people. And it should be student-focused.
One of the basic precepts that I think is worth reminding people of is that our entire system of government, from the top to the bottom, is supposed to be a representative system. Now, to me, that has a certain given to it, and Thomas Jefferson addressed this when he talked about the need to have the books of the nation's government so simple that your average shopkeeper could understand them. Now, I would think it would flow from that the books of your local school district ought to be at least that understandable. But we are, like you say, only 5 people in the state maybe understand it. I know when I was reporting on this, Dale Dennis with Kansas State Department of Education was certainly one who understood it. Accountant who works right across the street from KPI's offices, who I spoke with quite often, understood it and was able to help me to try to understand it. And I wasn't aware of too many others who did. That just, to me, fundamentally goes against the basic concept that we have a representative form of government. We give government, including our school districts, the authority to take our money, to spend it for the common good. But if we don't have a way to understand what they're doing with it, how they're taking it, how the formula works, that seems like a fundamental problem.
It is. And in addition to not understanding how the formula works, it's also very challenging to get the end product, financial statements, available to the public. We helped get a law passed last year, or actually in 2013, that requires school districts to publish a budget summary with an easily identifiable link on their homepage. We went back and tested that. It took effect the following July. We went back and tested that a few months ago and found that most districts, we did a random test of 27 districts, we found 2 that were in compliance with that state law, that transparency law. And after we did the research, and I went in to testify on a bill to change that, to put some teeth into it, because you're supposed to do it, but there's no penalty for not doing it. So I had to amend that testimony because one of those 2 districts that was in compliance had since pulled it down. They do not want citizens to understand exactly how much is being spent, because what happens when people find out that you're not spending $4,000, you're actually spending $12,000 or $13,000, a lot of hard questions start being asked. And so there's an effort to try to prevent citizens from having the facts. And this school funding formula is so complex. No one really knows. I mean, and it allows, because it has this one element of base state aid, that's the one piece that the education community tends to focus on. And citizens think that might be the only thing that school districts receive. Right. We need something that's going to be easy to explain, easy to see, that says this is how much your school district is receiving.
Right. Well, in this complex set of formulas that goes in, and school districts get more money if they have too much of this or too little of this, or there's just so many things that go into it, it's open to gaming the system. And there have been some districts that have been sort of caught doing that, aren't there?
In a number of ways. In some cases with virtual education, there's a lot of questions about what's called at-risk, which is funding that's supposed to go to help low-income kids. But there's nothing in this current school funding formula that actually requires the money to be spent on the kids. You can't trace it. Now, there's theories that it's supposed to be, for example, at risk. That funding is supposed to be used for kids who are at risk. But it's been interpreted that if an at-risk child is in the classroom, not necessarily receiving any particular unique service, if they're just present in the classroom, then some of the at-risk money can be used to pay that teacher salary, or the principal salary, or the custodian salary, or the utility bills. It's not necessarily all going, or even the majority of it going, for services that are directly related to the students who are generating that funding.
Right. And of course, all those other things you mentioned, they need to be done. I mean, a school needs a janitor, a school needs all those other administrative functions at some level. But the point is that it's a disconnect with the argument that the school lobby typically makes, that, oh, it's for the children, we need more. Because when you follow the money, it's really not getting to the children in many instances.
It's not. It's not. And you're right. I mean, certainly you need a certain level of administration and support services and so forth. But when you look at the wide disparity of how that's done and what's spent on a per pupil basis, you find pretty quickly that some districts are spending a lot more than is necessary to provide the service. No one's saying that you should not provide the service. It's a matter of providing the service, a good quality service, at the best price.
Right. And one of the things that has been a mantra is a child shouldn't be penalized because of the zip code they're born into. And that's an argument for the equity push, that, you know, a child born into a rural district that doesn't have a lot of property value shouldn't have less of an opportunity to get a quality education than a child born into a property-rich district that generates more property property taxes to help fund the schools. But there's some problems with that, as KPI has pointed out as well, with what's called equalization aid. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. The equalization, and you'll hear legislators commonly explain it this way. Well, one mill in this district might raise $50,000, whereas one mill in Blue Valley, for example, in Johnson County, raises $2.3 million. And so equalization is to offset that disparity. That's the theory. What we find is that instead of doing it based on property valuation, it's done on per pupil property valuation. So it has the perverse effect of actually, there's dozens of districts where one mill raises $50,000 who are considered property rich and ineligible for equalization aid. But every district in Johnson County, which is probably the most affluent district county in the state, every district there is considered property poor by this broken school finance formula, and say we need to give them extra money, equalization money, because they're property poor. That's nonsense.
Well, it seems to fly in the face of some basic understanding of efficiencies. If you have a more dense population with more modern schools, because there's growth and development of schools, things are going to tend to run more efficiently. You have to spend less on maintenance. You have these new facilities. You don't have to spend as much on a fleet of buses to pick two kids up that are 40 miles away from school or whatever, like you do in some of these rural districts. And so, to me, it seems a lot of this should be common sense, but the formula just flies in the face of it.
But common sense is something that often is checked at the door when you're talking about things related to the legislature. You know, it's also indicative, because as you were saying there, it struck something with me. You said it's how this impacts the district and what the district does, and what about how it impacts the citizens?
Right.
So if a school district needs to, say, they want to do something that's going to cost $200,000, in those little districts where one mill raises $50,000, they have to raise four mills of property tax on the citizens in that district. If Blue Valley wants to spend $200,000, where 1 mil raises $2.3 million, it's a fraction of 1 mil. So we tend to not focus in these discussions on the impact on citizens. And we certainly need to provide schools the money that they need to educate students, but we also have to be fair to citizens in the process.
Right. Excellent point. Well, this is certainly has been a morass for many years. It would be really great to see something more intelligible come out of this. And the idea of just saying to schools, kind of taking a time out and say, okay, we're going to block grant you money for a couple of years, make sure you're, you know, sort of held harmless in this, and then do a real analysis and an intelligent solution to how do we fund our schools in Kansas.
I agree. I mean, we need to take the time to do it. You don't want to rush something. It needs to be done very thoughtfully, and there are a lot of different circumstances that need to be taken into account. But we need to go back and look at what are students achieving, what are districts spending, because the spending is all over the map. The achievement levels, when you get down to the individual student cohorts, like low income versus not low income, the achievement levels are much closer. And yet the spending is very, very wide, high to low. And so you need to take time to sort out all the extenuating circumstances that exist, urban versus rural, and size of district and so forth, and come up with a formula that fairly gives districts what they need and in a student-focused way that everybody can understand. That's going to take some time, but it's something that absolutely has to be done. Until we do, we'll never get out of this court cycle. Schools will continue to sue taxpayers for more money because there will never be enough money. And the sad thing is, giving districts, if we gave them everything they wanted, of course they'd come back in a year or two and say we need more, but we've increased funding dramatically in the last 10 years, and it really hasn't made a difference in student achievement. The danger in just spending more is that citizens think, well, the problem's solved, and my kids are going to be okay, and it's just not true. The money is not going to go where it needs to be. We'll be spending more, but not spending it where we need to spend it. And that's part of what this formula has to do. So we think it makes great sense to sunset the current formula, do the block grant so the districts have plenty of money to operate in the meantime, and also they have plenty of opportunity to start looking at how they can operate more efficiently and make better use of the money they're getting so they have more opportunities with it. But then put together a formula that makes sense, that people can understand and schools can operate efficiently with.
Outstanding. Yeah, time to sweep out some of those cobwebs and look at what's actually happening and get it figured out. For our listeners, if they want more information, as always, they can go to kansaspolicy.org and look up the data on kansasopengov.org.
Right.
Very good. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Paul.